just before we start, let's just have a moment of silence for, you know, beings who are being killed and maimed in the war from any side, and not just humans, but four-leggeds and creatures of all sorts. And what I wanted to talk about tonight is that, you know, it's times of conflict like this that we can see the piercing power of the Buddha's realization of no enemies toward all sentient beings. And it's so amazing how he held that. So I want to explore that a little bit with you all and see if it lands. You know, and I'm not going to name any names, but just with the war in Ukraine could broaden into a wider conflict. We can turn towards the Buddha's wisdom and his equanimity in hard times to inform our own. And this understanding of no enemies is a way in which it's right at the heart of what he taught, and tempered by how he navigated the political realities of his time. Because the 40 years that he spent teaching, wandering the Ganges Valley of what is now northern India, was actually full of all kinds of strife and inequity and difficulty. It wasn't just this amazing, benign wonderland he was in. It was very imperfect, much like 2022. And it tested his awakening, and it also tempered it and defined it in terms of how he had to respond to difficult situations. So, as usual, you know, how his awakened mind informed what he did really helps us see how we can be. And in particular, in relative to what's going on in this world, in his travels, about 350 miles, you know, from east to west, he crossed the borders of the Magadha and Kosala kingdoms and also the Vajan Republic. And he sometimes found himself stuck between rulers, kings of these various kingdoms, because there wasn't such a thing as India then, on the brink of war. At least one occasion toward the end of his life, he talked the king of the Magadha kingdom, Ajatasattu, down from attacking the Vajan Republic. God talked him out of it indirectly through a minister. And sometimes this difficulties hit close to home, such as when his first patron and friend, King Bimbisara, was overthrown by his own son, Ajatasattu, and imprisoned and eventually died in prison. Bimbisara did, within earshot maybe of the Buddha. It was just not too many miles away from the bamboo grove up in Rajagir. So, and yet through all of his life, the Buddha didn't speak, he could be blunt sometimes, but he didn't speak ill of anyone. And he always acted from wisdom and compassion. And you can see, we talked about it last time in a different way, this whole business with Angulimala. He always had this recognition that even the most difficult person had the potential to awaken. They always did. And in this case, even the most despicable despot in terms of his time. So this is something we can really bring into our hearts now when there's a group of leaders orchestrating the invasion of a country. And how can we see how this influences how we think? And a good place to look at this is one of the masterpieces of the Pali Canon, Digha Nikaya number 2, the Samanaphala Sutta. It's pretty amazing. And in this case, this very king, Ajatasattu, who was the one who had killed his father, had become plagued with misgivings about what he'd done, how he leveraged his way into power by killing his father. It's this really long sutta, and he's like uneasy in the beginning. He's sort of uneasy, and he's talking to his courtiers, and he say, well, who can I go talk to who might be able to help me out? And they said, well, there's this teacher. And he said, no, not that one. And there's this teacher. No, not that one. And then someone said, well, there's the Buddha. It's almost kind of bizarre. It's like, why didn't you think of that? Because he knew the Buddha. He grew up around the Buddha. The Buddha was around. But anyway, he said, okay. So he goes and talks to the Buddha with 500 elephants with his harem, supposedly came too. But anyway, it's an incredibly long sutta where the Buddha gave the king one of the most elegantly framed descriptions of the path of awakening anywhere in the suttas. It's extraordinary. It's really long, incredibly deep. So it's so interesting. Why was he spending so much time with this guy who had killed one of his closest associates, King Bimbisara, his first patron? And at the beginning, there's this very long section on ethics. And then the Buddha says, great king, the bhikkhu who is thus possessed of moral discipline sees no danger anywhere in regard to his restraint by moral discipline. He's almost like poking him a little bit. And then he teaches, goes on, he teaches about guarding the sense doors, about the jhanas, about the operation of mindfulness, about the divine knowledges, about all the powers that happen on the path, about recollecting past lives, freedom from suffering. And he keeps going all through all these refrains and all this amazing use of metaphor. And he keeps referring to Ajahasattu as great king repeatedly. And but at the same time, he's the guy who overthrew his dad. It's really interesting that that is the case. And so powerful. He's giving this great depth of Dharma. And, and the thing about the Buddha is he listens when he speaks. He only says stuff to people that they can hear. You can really start to figure that out when you read the suttas a lot. He isn't just like kind of talk at people. You know, if there's a farmer and he just knows about farming, he'll use all kind of farming metaphors. And he speaks to the level that people can hear. So here he's giving this incredible to this person who acted despicably. And then, okay, I already said he murdered. And he doesn't, so the Buddha's not regarding King, this killer, as his enemy, but as a being who could awaken, just like any being can. So we got to remember that, you know, as we think about what's happening on the other side of the world in Ukraine right now, we might start to think of some people with roles in that as inherently evil or something. But we can disagree with their actions, but down at the very core of them, they could awaken just like us. And they're not enemy. They're not enemy. And the king is so moved by this teaching that he's able, this is so interesting, he's able to articulate his own crime. He says to the Buddha, he says, "Venerable sir, a transgression overcame me. I was so foolish, so deluded, so unskillful, that for the sake of rulership, I took the life of my own father, a righteous man and a righteous king. Let the Exalted One acknowledge my transgression as a transgression for the sake of my restraint in the future." So because he gave so much, his heart opened so he could say, yeah, I did this terrible thing. And the Buddha replies, "Since you have seen your transgression as a transgression and make amends for it according to the Dhamma, we acknowledge it. For, great king, this is growth in the discipline of the Noble One, that a person sees his transgression as a transgression, makes amends for it according to the Dhamma, and achieves restraint in the future." But then the king does this funny thing, which happens repeatedly in the suttas, when the Buddha is teaching someone who could almost get it, except they don't quite, because they're involved in samsaric life. And he says, "Well, now, venerable sir, we must go. We have many tasks and duties." And the Buddha always says, as you, whatever seems right to you, great king. So the king goes off. And this is one of these moments where the king missed an opportunity. Maybe he could have practiced then instead of going off and being busy. Because after he leaves, the Buddha talks to the monastics. And he says, this king bhikkhus has ruined himself. He has injured himself. Because if this king had not taken the life of his father, a righteous man and a righteous king, then in this very seat, there would have been arisen in him the dust-free, stainless eye of the Dharma. So he was on the brink of stream entry, the king was. And he could have done it if he hadn't killed his father. So this amazing, you know, he had that possibility. And I think if I remember right, he spent a lot of time in the hell realms and then later on awakens. That's usually how these things go. But it's pretty powerful. It's pretty powerful. So here in 2022, fog of war, pervading stuff around us, you know, we can just learn from the Buddha as someone who's been there. I'm going to suggest three things we might take in about this time, these attitudes that we might apply in our own lives. By the way, is anyone getting cold with that? Could you close that? I don't think we need it. I sort of did in the morning. It was hot when I came in. Thank you. Thank you, my friend. So the first and foremost is just, there are no enemies. I mean, you just aren't. You know, when we're in the path, there are no enemies. And this can be difficult to embrace. I mean, we've had political circumstance that's been difficult in the last few years, and people do stuff about people of color that we find difficult, some of all kinds of things, you know, but there are no enemies. It's so important. And we may think that about, you know, in terms of climate change and what's happening to the planet and people who seem to be more focused on short-term gain than anything about that, but they aren't enemies. They're beings who could awaken, just to keep cultivating that in the middle of all these difficulties. So, you know, we can see that partly because look at how our understanding of our own nature changes our understanding of others that we might consider enemies. Because, you know, as we deepen our own practice, our own inner poisons, our mistakes, our attachments become clear to us. That we end up staring everything in the eyeball. You know, the places where we've transgressed, where we've hurt people, where we put ourselves before others. And also as we practice, it becomes clear that there's no static self that did these things. There's a stream of conditioning. There were causes and conditions. There were imprints. That's part of the beauty of the practice, is it starts to unpack and we find the wounds and the things we regret. It's not inherently us. It's something we did. We realize that everything's a product of causes and conditions, and that's our avenue for freedom. So we're not just this singular static personage. There's no inherent self. We're a patchwork of attitudes created from this lifetime, other lifetimes, we don't know. That's how our own internal journey starts to unfold. And remember, the Buddha bade us cultivate mindfulness internally and externally. Internally and externally. So as this journey of clearer seeing goes on within us, also it clarifies our understanding of those around us, externally, others, and what's going on with them. And we start to realize that they too are a patchwork of attitudes and conditioned arisings. There's no inherent self there either. I'll tell a story here. One time, a long, long time ago, kind of in the spring of 1970, when I was a student at the University of Wisconsin, some of you may know that was the peak of the Cambodia riots during the war. It was right up there with Berkeley. It was intense. We had 10,000 National Guard in the city and a Kroger burning down, and it was intense during all that time. And there was one demonstration before the very intense part at the end, but this was a bunch of Brown Berets, Chicano Brown Berets, what they call them, Chicanos then, I guess, I don't know what they'd be now, sorry if that was wrong. But anyway, from Milwaukee, came and they took over the state assembly chambers in Madison, Wisconsin, because of something about welfare, I don't know, but I just kind of... I can't be informed about the tactics or the issues or anything, but anyway, I went along. So, a little bit embarrassing, but we broke into the state assembly chambers and there we were inside, and there was like thousands of police outside, and it was hairy. And so what they finally did was, and it was pretty cool, I gotta say, it was smart, the police in full riot gear, you know, black, the whole deal, full riot gear, the whole deal. They filed into the state assembly chambers and went all the way around the perimeter. So we were utterly surrounded, and there was this long, flat marble stairway, this long, you know, straight stairway that went down to the street a couple floors from where the, anyway, they squeezed us out of the building. They just started moving in, and we had no choice but to leave, and they could have just pulverized us. But what I remember, and why it's relevant to this, is walking down the stairway, which was lined with riot police with batons and full gear and masks and armor and everything with these batons, and you see their fingers twitching on the batons because they just wanted to pulverize this bunch of hippies and Latino persons. And it was interesting because it was scary, but I saw how much they objectified and feared us and hated us. And we were kind of doing the same to them. So there was this mutual, utter misunderstanding, enemies on both sides. And it was kind of this turning point in my mind, in my heart, because I just kind of got it. Like, wow, look at that. They, you know, they don't think they think they're doing the right thing. They think they're on the side of law. They think we're just crazy renegades taking over the state assembly chamber. We had a whole different point of view. But it was something that it stuck with me for the rest of my life. And I was starting my practice. I mean, I was already meditating then. So it was, you know, integrated with the beginning of my spiritual practice. And it just broke through this idea of enemies right there. And so the polarities of the 60s are in a crazy kind of way. It's not that different from the polarities of now, because it was extreme then. I mean, you know, if you were counterculture, and then there was the war, and people were for the war and against the war, it was intense. So it's not that different. And it's hard not to be polarized and to think the other side is enemies. But ultimately, there's no such thing. On a conventional level, you know, we take position, we demonstrate, fund, activate, vote, whatever we're going to do, that's fine. But ultimately, in terms of the ability to awaken, in terms of ultimately who beings are, there's no such thing. And the Buddha never did that. He just didn't. He just didn't. And so even in this conflict, perhaps good and evil seems crystal clear sometimes, but keep working on it. You know, keep looking deeper. I saw this news piece about a Russian actor who was disowned by his mother. The Russian actor lives in the West, and his mother disowned him because he was trying to convince her through some kind of texting thing that this war was unfair, and she was so convinced that he was absolutely wrong, she disowned him. He was the enemy, her own son, you know, because she sees things differently. So we just kind of take those things in, and on our ultimate level, bring that into our hearts. It's important for the world that we can do that. It's important for the world because we humans aren't objects. We aren't even solid selves. And the more we can see the reality of not self, of anatta, see we're made of component parts, as are those who oppose us, then we realize this lack of inherent selfhood, and then there's nobody who could be our enemy any more than we could be anyone else's. And that's, you know, that's an extraordinary quality of these great moral leaders of our time, Nelson Mandela, Martin Luther King, the Dalai Lama. They don't demonize those who oppose them or even imprison them. They have opponents, but they don't have enemies. Dalai Lama always refers to, and I've heard him do it, my Chinese brothers and sisters. And he reaches out with genuine love and compassion for Chinese people and talks about the rulers with compassion. And the main thing I've ever heard is sorrow for the karmic difficulties they may be causing themselves in the future. But it's never enemies. It's compassion. Even when they've, you know, there's genocide going on, even then. They're not enemies. So second is to cultivate wise mindfulness of feelings of animosity, which is down in this area of the Vedanas. Because as the Buddha so brilliantly taught, we need to cultivate mindfulness of our responses to arising phenomena, especially if they're pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. You know, this is this real interesting area of the Satipatthana Sutta. This is where the rubber hits the road, right? In this area, how we respond to this horrific pain going on out there. And we encounter something before we know anything about it. We experience pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And that's kind of one area where enemies arise. We have this gut unpleasant, and we tend to make someone we think is causing that an enemy. And this is a real powerful tool to bring into this discussion. And Vedanas are so important. Second of the four foundations and the second of the five factors of our sense of self, the skandhas, and all kinds of dangerous forms of, you know, bigotry and reaction and racism and homophobism and sexism come out of unmindfully handled Vedanas. People see someone, encounter someone, they look different somehow, the color of the skin, their racial origins, the way they're manifesting gender preference, all those kind of things, and then they become other and they become enemy. So to be able to be aware of that when it's happening and see what's going on in ourselves, because I know I've fallen into that. I can see myself reacting in this conflict and forming, making someone an SR2 anyway, because negative Vedana arises, unpleasant arises. But in the spiritual path, as we do this practice, the Vedanas start to reveal if we're working with them. You know, just paying attention to the fact that they exist, and when a time of conflict or difficulty, we label something as unpleasant, and the next step is to concretize them as enemy. But if we can catch it, just when it arises, when unpleasant arises, and see that's what it is, it can stop us from taking the next enemy step and realize it's just unpleasant. Just unpleasant. And if we look into the heatedness of, you know, I mean, I've been tracking the news pretty closely, and it just seems like a surging maelstrom of Vedanas, basically unpleasant. It could just drag us into all kinds of reactivity, but to be able to recognize that and not be dragged in, and at the same time, you know, whatever, however we want to track things, do what seems right to us. It's important. And then the third thing is, you know, equanimity and how we can balance through hard times. And it's a aspect of how we can not have someone become enemy. And the way equanimity is brought into the Buddha's teachings is really unique and powerful. It's one of the four Brahma Viharas, and it links this primary axis of wisdom with loving kindness. They kind of come together in equanimity. So it's really interesting and extraordinary in that way. And in this situation, you know, wise equanimity, deep equanimity is like a wise and loving response to tumultuous conditions. So it's wise and it's loving, interlaced at the same time. And it comes out of our insight, comes out of the perspective that we develop about who we are and who others are and what it means. Because on the one hand, equanimity arises from the wisdom of insight, from seeing there's no intrinsic reality anywhere, even in the political leaders who may seem to embody all that is wrong. There's nothing intrinsically there. So we see through it with wisdom. And on the other hand, equanimity arises out of loving kindness and compassion and sympathetic joy. And we can cultivate this boundlessness of human kindness in the middle of difficulty. So it doesn't mean indifference. Doesn't mean flatlining, equanimity. It really points to full engagement and doing what we will do out of that engagement, out of that connection. So when you think of these beings who are kind of moral compasses for our time in the late 20th century, and you look at what they would do, they embody that the equanimity, this combination of wisdom and compassion. Whether it's Mahatma Gandhi or Martin Luther King, they held both. That's part of what their power is in the middle of fierce opposition. I mean, Martin Luther King, he was heckled, he was spat on, he was arrested, he was beaten, and then he was killed. But he never stopped cultivating loving kindness, even towards those who considered him an enemy, and he might be justified for considering them an enemy, but he didn't. Amazing speech in 1957, citing the words of Jesus, Martin Luther King said, we have to love our enemy, bless them that curse us, do good to those that hate us, pray for those who spitefully use us. And then as a quote, he says, "Let me hasten to say that Jesus was very serious when he gave this command. He wasn't playing. He realized that it's hard to love your enemies. He realized that it's difficult to love those persons who seek to defeat you, those persons who say evil things about you. He realized that it was painfully hard, pressingly hard, but he wasn't playing. And we cannot dismiss this passage as just another example of Oriental hyperbole, just a sort of exaggeration to get over the point. This is a basic philosophy of all that we hear coming from the lips of our master." So he could be forgiven for this Oriental hyperbole, whatever he meant by that, but it's so powerful what he's talking about. And this is someone who really was in the trenches. And he couldn't anticipate then in 1957 how many great Tibetan Buddhist masters would be subject to years of servitude and torture in Chinese prisons, and how they would come out with their compassion intact. I've heard these amazing stories, only regretting the moments when their minds had wavered towards hatred, toward their captors. So some extraordinary stories about that. The Buddha also set a high bar in a famous sutta. Some of you have heard this, a simile of the saw. It's in the Majjhima Nikaya. It is. In a way that's accessible. And he says, mendicants, even if bandits work to sever you savagely limb by limb with a two-handled saw, one who gave rise to a mind of hate toward them would not be carrying out my teaching. Herein, mendicants, you should train thus. Our minds will remain unaffected, and we shall utter no evil words. We shall abide compassion for their welfare with a mind of loving kindness without inner hate. We shall abide pervading them with a mind imbued with loving kindness, and starting with them, we shall abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. That is how you should train mendicants. So that's a high bar, yeah? So that's exactly what he teaches about this. That's no enemies. If you're being cut in pieces with a two-handled saw, and the perpetrator of that is not an enemy, that is quite something. Doesn't mean you don't get away, but he's not an enemy, he or she. So just to get back to the beginning, compassion in hard times doesn't mean we step back or remove ourselves or turn away. It means we turn toward, but do it without demonizing, and do it recognizing the reactivity that goes on in us and not making opponents enemies. And then with deep equanimity, we can bring loving wisdom to any situation, to any person, to be the solution that's needed and that the world needs. That's it for a moment.